So let's take a look at the end of John chapter 10 and then the first part of John 11. Notice the title, Drop Everything, Come Heal Lazarus. And within this passage, we find that that is not what Jesus did. And so the statement is given to us in John chapter 11, verse 5. Now Lazarus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. So the question arises in this passage, is it loving that Jesus did not drop everything in order to heal Lazarus? This is a very significant passage, and we will find the answer to that and some other things that you might not have even thought of here in this passage. Let's look at the overall thrust of the outline. It has one more point than it does in your handout, but we have Jesus ministering in Bethany beyond the Jordan at the end of John chapter 10. Jesus had gone there as a result of persecution that happened at the Feast of Hanukkah when he made it clear that he is indeed equal to God. The charge was that he was a man making himself equal to God. There was no recognition among the leadership there in Jerusalem that instead he is God who has become man. They did not recognize their Messiah who had come to him. Jesus has gone to Bethany in order to get away from the hubbub, but also it is not yet time for him to die, and the level of pressure and persecution would have interfered with his ministry to his disciples, and it would have been counterproductive. So he has taken some time east of the Jordan River in a place that our English Bibles say Bethany, but it is actually the region of Bethania. Let's set up the chronology of the passage and the geography. So let's look here. I've set this forth of the basic timeline of Jesus' ministry, mainly arranged around the feasts that are recorded in John's Gospel. There are a few other events, his baptism. Pesach, by the way, stands for Passover, but that's the Hebrew word for Passover. It's much shorter, so it fits better here on the slide. So we have four Passovers that occurred during Jesus' ministry. And then with three of them being recorded in John's Gospel. Luke chapter 6:1 gives an implication of another Passover, of the second Passover, that is two out of the four. The time period that we are looking at right now is between Hanukkah, which was the last part of John 10, John 22, 10, 22 and following. And then we will come starting at John chapter 12. We will be in the vicinity of another Passover. So we are here in John 11, somewhere between Hanukkah and Passover. Let's nail that down a little tighter. Now, on the right-hand side is something that probably most of you have not seen. This is what the Jewish Talmud looks like. That area that's bordered by purple in the middle is what is called the Mishnah. The Mishnah itself was a commentary on the Old Testament. It would comment on individual verses and they would draw implications, some of them legitimate, some of them not. The Talmud, in turn, was a commentary on the Mishnah. So it could be seen as, imagine a target. And as you look at this, it looks a bit like a target. That is, there's a bullseye. The real bullseye would be the Old Testament passage. Out from that one ring would be the Mishnah, and out from that would be the various comments within the Talmud. And so they would surround it like the rings of a target surround the bullseye. The Talmud is not early. We're looking probably at around the 4th or 5th century, whereas the Mishnah would probably date to the 2nd century with some of the things going back to the 1st century. The level of accuracy of this statement, there are points where it is not a correct reporting. It says, on the eve of the Passover, well, no, Jesus was crucified actually on Passover, but it says, on the eve of Passover, Yeshu was hanged. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, "He is going forth to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy." No such herald went out for 40 days, but it would not be unreasonable to say that the raising of Lazarus may well have been 40 days before the crucifixion. I wouldn't guarantee it, but it's very possible that this has some vestiges of historical fact that would fit well. The time for that would be February 22nd, if it were indeed 40 days prior to the crucifixion. So now let's look at geography. I'd like for you to hold your place, but look at John chapter 10, verse 40. And there it says, "So he departed and went across the Jordan to the place," and I have put in brackets in my translation is in your notes, "where John was baptizing at first, and he remained there." Now turn back, hold your place here, but turn to John chapter 1, verse 28. In John 1, 28, we are told that the things that occurred prior to this verse, verses 15 through 27, these things were done in Bethany. That would be the English rendering of the proper Greek text. Bethany beyond the Jordan, where John was baptizing. The King James and New King James have a variant that is not well represented. They say Bethabara. But Bethany is the location. That's the way that John has spelled it. There was no such thing as standardized spelling until the printing press. Josephus, in his writings, mentions Botanea on a number of occasions, but spells it three different ways. Bethany was one of the ways that Botanea was spelled. Back in Old Testament times, you might look at Psalm 22. This is the region of Bashan. Botanea is derived from the Aramaic, and Aramaic speakers did not like the SH sound, so they tended to replace it. They would put a letter that would be T or TH. So Botanea is the locale by its political name. Bethany is an alternate spelling and alternate pronunciation of it. If you look at the map, the inset map, the blue one in the lower right corner, it's showing Israel, and then up in the upper corner of that, you see a black box. That black box is given a little more detail as you look at the depiction above it. And so you'll notice that this is the region east of the Jordan River. The Jordan River actually goes through Caesarea Philippi, which is north of where it is showing on this, the Jordan River going, but it starts up on Mount Hermon. And so Botanea is essentially the region that is east of the northern part of the Jordan River. It is also east of the Sea of Galilee, which is a widening of the Jordan River, and Lake Hula, which is also a widening of the Jordan River. So that is the locale. We talked about that at length in John chapter 1 in order to establish that this was the location. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but now if you look at the map on the right, on the left-hand side, you'll see it in more detail. I've put an H in the middle of Lake Hula and a G in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. Now, if you were to look at a modern map for Lake Hula, you would not find it, because in the 1940s, they started doing land reclamation because there were a lot of mosquitoes. They were having a major problem with malaria. So that area, instead of being swamp and lake, is now essentially farmland, and they do not have the mosquito problems that they once did. Okay, once again, looking at the time and place, it's a very interesting thing that John chapter 1, we have Jesus meeting up a second time with John the Baptist after his baptism. His baptism was more than 40 days prior to the start of the narrative in John 1. That is, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when they record the baptism, which John's gospel does not, they are actually starting prior to the starting point of the narrative in John. Well, you'll notice that Jesus went back and forth between Galilee and Jerusalem a number of times as one looks at his ministry in the Gospel of John. Then we come up to Hanukkah. He is in Jerusalem. And then, late in John chapter 10, he goes to Botanea. John 11, he goes to Bethany. So notice the play on words, Bethany and Botanea. He goes from, shall we say, Bethany to Bethany. End of John chapter 11, he goes to Ephraim, and then John chapter 12, he's back in Jerusalem. He ends up the book in Galilee, John chapter 21, and then after the book of John, in the book of Acts, we have the start of the church age at the day of Pentecost, and that is in Jerusalem. So there is quite a bit of movement within the Gospel of John, but importantly, John's Gospel starts with its first geographic location being Botanea, and here we have a return to Botanea, and then Jesus moves on to Bethany. As we look at John chapter 10, verse 41, it says that and many came to him and were saying, John did no sign, but everything that John said about this man was true. So many there believed in him. Notice, this is a return of in the Gospel of John to Botanea, where John the Baptist had ministry at the beginning of at the beginning of the Gospel of John. So John had been there for a while, and he had been predicting Jesus. And so these people remember what John had said, and they say, John did no sign. What is the implication? They are bringing up the fact that John did no signs because Jesus did many signs, including many signs there in Botanea. Clearly, the superiority of Jesus is being established, but that's something that John the Baptist himself always did. He always magnified Christ, he always minimized himself, he recognized that Jesus was everything, and that John himself only had a very minor role. And these people recognize that there are many that came to believe in him, as verse 42 says. Jesus has come up here in order to escape the persecution that he was facing in Jerusalem, but now suddenly he's going to face a crisis. And that is, he is going to be told in verses 1 through 6 of chapter 11 that Lazarus, who is in Bethany, is sick. He is very sick, and the sisters want him to come down immediately, drop everything, and come heal Lazarus. John chapter 11, verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Now Mary was who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Here is a photograph of Bethany from back in 1890. And if we could see over this first ridge, which is the Mount of Olives, down in that next valley is Jerusalem. So this is very close to Jerusalem. The picture dates back to 1890. If you look at the map on the left-hand side, you'll see on the right side of it Bethany, and then the road goes up through Bethphage and goes on over to Jerusalem, and it's less than 2 miles to get to Jerusalem. That's going to be important. John is going to mention that it is close to Jerusalem, but there will be a reason. Look at the map again. You'll see Bethphage, and then you'll notice under it in a grayish print, Mount of Olives. So between Bethany and Jerusalem is the Mount of Olives. Here is a more recent picture on the right-hand side, looking towards Jerusalem once again, from Bethany, looking up the Mount of Olives, and the tower that's there. If you look at the picture on the left, we're looking from the opposite direction, Mount of Olives, with all the tombs that are located on it. And that dates, the picture on the right dates from the 1940s, and on the left is much more recent. Now, in John chapter 11, verse 2, it mentions that Mary is the one who anointed Jesus' feet. I wanted to depict the way that Passover and other important meals were eaten. People were reclining, so Jesus would have his feet extended out on the triclinium upon which he is reclining. And so the position for Mary to anoint his feet, it's much simpler to see how that would have happened. She apparently, John had told his original readers about her. So they already are familiar with her by name. It does not mean that these are believers. It does not mean that the initial readers of this gospel had great familiarity with all of the events of the life of Jesus. It just means that as John has ministered to the original recipients, one of the things that he has told them about Jesus involved speaking about Mary and the fact that she anointed Jesus' feet. That's not mentioned, or the account appears in John chapter 12, but I just say this to indicate that there is no reason to say that, well, these people had great familiarity with the life of Jesus, because as many would imagine, well, they had already read the Synoptic Gospels. Matthew and Mark both give an account of this anointing at Bethany. But that's not the way that they heard of it. John is the first of the Gospels. But secondly, John is writing to unbelievers. And it is not that they have read the other accounts, which were written later. But it is that in John ministering to these people, he himself has mentioned this, and he mentions it again, or mentions the fact that he had mentioned it. Okay. Now, in verse 3, the fact that Lazarus was sick, there's a 4-day journey between these two places. And so, therefore, what needed to happen was the sisters sent a messenger carrying the message, and this is the message in verse 3. So the sisters sent him a message saying, "Behold, Lord, he whom you love is sick." The locale is quite a bit of distance between the two places. The site where John had been baptizing was very possibly Yardanit, or it could be north of the Sea of Galilee along the eastern side of the Jordan River. All of that north of the Yarmouk River is the region of Bataneia. Now you might say, well, I don't know where the Yarmouk River is. Well, let me point it out on the map. You see the place called Yardanit? That is where the picture on the upper left is. Well, just below it, you see a river that comes from the east by northeast, going in a southwesterly direction, and it flows into the Jordan River just south of the Sea of Galilee. That is the Yarmouk River, and everything north of that, on the east side of the Jordan River and the east side of the Sea of Galilee, is the region of Bataneia. So what we're looking at is a 4-day serious hike that messenger had to make in order to get up into the vicinity of the Sea of Galilee to be able to pass the message along to Jesus. So Jesus made a response in the hearing of the messenger. The idea was that the messenger would carry this word back to the sisters. So let's look at it. In verse 4, upon hearing this, Jesus said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister Mary and Lazarus. So Jesus is given a message that at first glance would be likely to be interpreted, "Lazarus will not die." He says, "This sickness is not unto death." But he is not speaking about death will not happen. What he is saying is, death will not be the final result of this. Let's see that Jesus actually gives indication of that within the statement itself. He says in the second clause of what he speaks, "But this sickness is for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified through it." Jesus is clearly pointing to he will have an intervention, but he is not clarifying whether his intervention will be before or after Lazarus dies. In any event, it is only because Jesus will intervene and there will be a miraculous sign performed that Jesus would be glorified through it. So he speaks of the glory of God and he speaks of the Son of God being glorified through it. He is clearly indicating he is going to do something, but he has not specified the order of events. The logical first impression would be, oh, Jesus said he's going to heal Lazarus. Lazarus isn't going to die. That is not what he meant, but that is what would have been inferred from his statement. That message has to go down to Bethany. It's going to take it 4 days to reach there. This is going to give the sisters some time to reflect upon things and to reflect upon what it is that Jesus is saying. Now, you know, they wanted Jesus to drop everything. They wanted him to come immediately and to heal Lazarus, and that is not what has happened. Now, Jesus loved Mary and Martha, and he loved Lazarus. And think back to verse 3 where the sisters said, Lord, the one whom you love is sick. Jesus had a very special relationship with all three of them, and they were appealing to his love, hoping that that would motivate him to drop everything. But Jesus had ministry, and he continued his ministry. He did not immediately suspend his ministry. There were many that were coming to believe, and Jesus knew in the timetable that the Father had given him that it was not yet time for him to go south. Is this the only time this has ever happened in the Gospel of John? Certainly not. Think back to John chapter 2. Jesus' first sign. He went to a wedding. And at that wedding, his mother, who seemed to have a ruling or a position of authority within the wedding, probably because the wedding involved relatives, she came up to Jesus and she said, they have no wine. Jesus said, ma'am, what is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come. He did not do the miracle of turning water to wine on his mother's timetable. He did it on his father's timetable. It was not saying he did not love his mother, but he made it clear that he is under the Father's authority. The royal official in John chapter 4 approached Jesus and said, come before my son dies. And Jesus told the royal official, go, your son lives. Jesus didn't drop everything and go. There are other occasions in John's gospel where he did not respond immediately. Jesus' brothers were demanding that he immediately drop everything in John chapter 7 and go to the Feast of Tabernacles. And he said, my time has not yet fully come. They went, and after they left, then he came down, but he didn't arrive for the beginning of the feast. We're told in John chapter 7 verse 14, he arrived in the middle of the feast. There were times that the Father's timetable was not the same as the timetable that people had. People were inclined to tell Jesus, drop everything, come here. And Jesus did not work on people's timetable. He worked on the Father's timetable, although in each of these instances, he accommodated the needs that people actually did have. Well, we ask the question, was his delay unloving? You know, all of us have experienced the frustration of being in the airport and having our flight delayed. And it is a major inconvenience. And you can imagine how distraught the sisters were, knowing that the messenger was going to take 4 days to get up to Jesus, and then it would take four more days, and who knows, maybe Lazarus won't live that long. I mean, they were distraught, and then Jesus isn't coming immediately. But we are reminded here in the passage that Jesus loved them. Now, there's something that's important to say about remarks like this. As we look at verse 5, it is a parenthesis. It's not part of the action of the passage. It's giving some background. It's telling us that we should not interpret Jesus doing what he did because he was unconcerned about Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. He indeed loved them. Now, you might be a little confused as you look at verse 6 and you see this, so. And it might be, so, as a result of him loving, he stayed two more days. In John's Gospel, when there's a parenthesis, words like so actually leapfrog over it, and it's going back to his statement, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified through it. Jesus delayed in order that God could be glorified, and in turn, the Father would glorify the Son through the sign that Jesus would do. What he did is loving, as we will find out as we see the details unfold in this passage. Well, in verse 7, Jesus announced a trip to Bethany. Bethany is a dangerous place. Bethany is very close to Jerusalem. Back in John chapter 10, the Judean leadership there in Jerusalem was ready to stone Jesus because they thought that he had blasphemed. Bethany is close to Jerusalem. Jesus is going to a very dangerous place. So he made the announcement to his disciples, verse 7. Then after this, he told the disciples, let's go to Judea again. They're shocked. You can't possibly mean that we need to go to Judea. That's a dangerous place. By the way, every one of Jesus' disciples except Judas was a Galilean. Judas, we find because of his name that he, Iscariot, that is his father's family, and he were from Cariote, which is in Judea. But the rest of the disciples were all Galileans. None of them particularly liked going down to Judea, especially because things had become very heated and there were death threats upon Jesus, as was announced back in John chapter 5, John chapter 7, and John chapter 10. Jesus answered, well, actually, the disciples are saying, are you sure that we should go back to Judea? You know, it's like the firefighter. They're the only ones that run into the fire. Everyone else runs away from it. The firefighter is running into it. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing. Jerusalem is a dangerous place. Bethany is very close to Jerusalem. Well, the disciples, being mainly Galileans, didn't particularly like going down to Judea. Isn't this an interesting sign? University of Advanced Tolerance. Christians not welcome. Well, you know, the disciples were finding that they were not welcome in Judea. But I'm going to argue that this passage in many ways is like a trial run on what's going to happen when Jesus is going to go to Jerusalem and actually have the predictions of the chief priests arresting him, of him being turned over to the Romans, of him going through trials and being beaten and finally crucified, but ultimately being resurrected. The apostles are also going to face a world that is opposed to them. They are seeing Jesus heading into the fire as they are going to need to head into the fire. In many senses, with the raising of Lazarus, it's like a trial run giving an object lesson to his disciples. You know, all the way along, Jesus' signs have been becoming more and more and more spectacular. This one here of raising Lazarus is as close as you can get to his own resurrection of all the signs that he did. And the disciples are seeing that Jesus is not running from the adversity. You know, later on, that cup that he had to drink, they also would drink. That is, they would face persecution as they stood up for Christ and ministered. You know, over time, the world became decidedly unfriendly to Christians. Rome eventually decided that Christians could be made into great sport in the Colosseum. Now, I'm going to digress a little bit, because you know, we have to ask ourselves, here in our country, things are becoming less friendly to Christianity than they were not many years before. I mean, things are changing. So I would like to make a little bit of comment upon what this line of the Bill of Rights in our Constitution actually means. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. What does the phrase an establishment of religion mean? And you might say, well, that's easy. Not so fast. Not so fast. First question, is the word establishment passive or active? Now, establishment itself is a noun, but it derives from the verb establish. And verbs can be active or passive. And establishment is what is called a verbal noun. That is, it is a noun by form, but it has verbal ideas contained within it. Now, the verb establish allows either a passive meaning or an active meaning. Many people interpret it as though it is passive. Now, if it were passive, it would mean an establishment of religion. That is, an established religion. If you have a past participle, which established is, that becomes the way that we make a passive form, an already established religion. So many people understand the Establishment Clause as saying, hands off. The government is supposed to have hands off in regard to established religions, already established religions. Many people then make the statement, they say, well, the Constitution speaks of a separation of church and state. Those words do not appear. The words that appear are an establishment of religion. Our Constitution, unlike the Russian Constitution, does not speak of a separation of church and state. So many who assume a passive meaning for the word establishment also wrongly assume that it means separation of church and state, and so they would wrongly claim the church, the state is supposed to leave the church alone and the church is supposed to leave the state alone. In other words, Christians unwelcome in government and so forth. Of the people who advocate freedom from religion and other atheists, this is where they're coming from. Now, I asked, is the word establishment passive or active? I would argue, and I believe that there is very good precedent from the writers themselves that they understood it to have an active meaning. And so establishment as an active would mean to establish a national religion. Now, what I have depicted here on this world map are countries that do have a national religion where government and the religious entity are one in the same. And that is the case in Great Britain, as you'll notice if you look at the map. And so what the Establishment Clause was saying is they did not want a repeat of what had occurred in Britain, of having the Anglican Church. Here in the United States, it's not allowed to be called the Anglican Church because Anglican equals Church of England. England. So Anglican means Church of England. And so here in the United States, it's not allowed to call itself that, so they call themselves Episcopalian. But the Establishment Clause is saying the federal government is not allowed to establish a national religion. Now, notice, in the Establishment Clause, it prohibits Congress from establishing a religion. Does it say anything about the states? No. Congress is federal. There shall not be a state religion. That is a national religion. But individual states, individual colonies did have their own state religions. Now, I wouldn't want the state of Tennessee to declare an official religion, but specifically, all that is prohibited is the federal government establishing a national religion. It does not say anything about what the states can or cannot do, what counties can or cannot do, what municipalities can or cannot do, or townships or school districts. It is absolute nonsense when people try to apply this establishment clause to saying you can't have prayer before a school district meeting. That's absolute nonsense. They don't understand the Constitution. I'll get off my soap opera, but I thought that that was important to say because what Jesus is warning his disciples about through this trial run is that they are going to face persecution just as he faced persecution, and they must not run away from it either, because they have a message of life, and they are ministering on behalf of the one who has the power of resurrection and life. So what man can do of even putting to death does not have eternal ramifications. And the word is supposed to go forth boldly, because we serve a risen Savior who is able to raise people from the dead, as he raised Lazarus, and as he raised himself, and as he will raise believers. Now, the disciples are fearful. They say, "Jesus, why are you going back to Judea? Why are you taking us back to Judea? They wanted to kill you." And Jesus says, "Aren't there 12 hours of daylight?" Look at that. Look at verse 9. His answer to verse 8, where they said, "Rabbi, Judeans were now seeking to stone you," chapter 10. "So are you going there again? You going to the place of danger?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daytime? If anyone walks during daytime, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world." He sees the sunlight. He doesn't stumble. Jesus has made a number of allusions in John's gospel to the fact that he knows when it is that he's going to be put to death. He told his mother, "My hour has not yet come." And that refrain continues through the gospel of John until we get to John chapter 12. He's always saying, "My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come." John chapter 12, things are going to change. Turn forward in John chapter 12 and let's look there. We have an occasion that I will talk about at more length when we get there, but I'll introduce it. We have some Grecians that wanted to see Jesus. Verse 20 of John 12. "Now there were some Greeks or Grecians among those who came up to worship at the feast. And they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and asked him, saying, 'Sir, we wish to see Jesus.' Philip came and told Andrew, and in turn Andrew and Philip told Jesus. But Jesus answered them, saying, 'The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified.'" This is the first time in the book of John that he said the hour has come. Let's move forward to John chapter 13. "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father." Something has changed here. Something changed from before John 12 right here in John chapter 12. When we get there, I'm going to discuss of a timetable that was given in the Old Testament, and it turned out that on Palm Monday of the year 33, that was the point that an Old Testament prophecy was completed and Jesus could then be crucified. Before that, he could not be. It was not in the Father's timetable. What is he alluding to when he says, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight?" And here we have depicted a sundial, an Israeli sundial, an ancient one. He's saying, while it's daylight, don't have to worry about stumbling. Remember when he healed the blind man in John chapter 9? He said, "We must do, or I must do the works of God while it is daylight. When night comes, no one can work." Light in both of these passages is referring to daylight, the time while Jesus is still ministering during his first coming. Night is looking at the point that he would die. What he's saying is, yeah, it's 11:45 out of the 12 hours of daylight. He's saying, it's not yet dark, I'm safe. Now, the disciples don't understand that he's talking about that it's not yet time for him to die. The Old Testament prophecy has not yet been brought to its 12th hour. And he's saying, though, in a somewhat hidden way, I'm still safe. I can still minister. I can go down to Judea. We'll be safe there. You may remember when Jesus was with the disciples in boats at various times that there were occasions when they were worried about drowning. And Jesus, on one occasion in Luke, rebuked them for their disbelief. And you look at the context and you say, well, what did they disbelieve? He had said, we are going to cross to the other side. They got into the boat. There was a storm. That storm wasn't going to prevent Jesus' word from coming true. Jesus said they were going to cross over to the other side. They were going to do it. Jesus' word is certain. Jesus is here saying, you don't have to worry about this. I'm safe. You'll be safe too. So, what we have is Jesus is proposing to make an eight-day round trip to Bethany in order to wake up Lazarus. 4 days down, and if he comes back, it would be 4 more days back here. Notice verse 11 is where he introduces this. But he said these things, and after this he told them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going so that I may wake him. And there's the disciples are saying, we don't need to wake him up. Actually, it's a good thing if he's sleeping. If you're really sick, you don't tend to get good sleep. And they're saying, Lazarus now is at the point of getting restful sleep. He's going to get well. We don't need to go down, Jesus. We're fine up here. Let's not go down there. There's no reason to go down to Judea. You know, here we have the guy that has insomnia, that's sick, and he's counting sheep, and he's doing everything to try to pass the night, and his eyes are wide open, and he cannot go to sleep. And they're saying, Lazarus is sleeping. Lazarus is recovering. We don't need to go. In their minds, the gears are turning. They think Jesus is talking about resting peacefully, not R.I.P., rest in peace, that is, in the tomb. Notice this is a passage that there are misunderstandings that are happening. The sisters would have understood Jesus to say, oh, this sickness is not going to culminate in death, therefore Lazarus won't die. And Jesus' disciples think that he's saying, well, I'm going to go wake up Lazarus because he's resting peacefully. Jesus has to correct their understanding. And it's, no, guys, I need to wake him from his sleep because it's rest in peace. Lazarus has died. Notice in verse 13, it says, although Jesus had spoken about his death, they supposed that he was speaking about restful sleep. Now, it's important to say something here. Christianity can view death for believers as sleep because it's temporary. We will be resurrected, and we already possess everlasting life. The unbeliever lacks hope. And so sleep is never applied to unbelievers. In regard to death, is not called sleep in the New Testament for unbelievers, but it is spoken of that way for believers because it is a temporary state, one that will be reversed because Jesus is both the resurrection and the life. And he has guaranteed everlasting life to believers at the moment that they believe in him for everlasting life, and he guarantees their resurrection. So in verse 14, Jesus then told them openly, Lazarus died. But now he makes a very surprising statement. And I rejoice for your sake, so you may believe, because I was not there. Let us go to him. He's saying, it was good for you. It's good, and I rejoice that I wasn't there to prevent him from dying, because when we go down there and I raise him from the dead, you will have some new content of faith to believe. You've already believed in me for everlasting life, that is, all of you except for Judas. But I want you to believe that I have the power to resurrect. As we've said, this passage is a precursor. It's a dry run for his own experience of death and resurrection. He's wanting for his disciples to understand he has the power over life and death, even in his own case. They haven't put those pieces together yet, and they will not have been pulled together until much later in John's narrative. Well, Thomas speaks up, and these are depicting lemmings that the legend has that they all go jumping off a cliff. And Thomas says, let us go also that we may die with him. And one has to ask here, what was his tone of voice? Was he saying seriously, okay, Jesus is going to die, let's join him? I rather doubt that, because when we see Thomas later, Thomas definitely doesn't have things put together about Jesus' resurrection. I think he's speaking here facetiously. Well, okay, guys, well, let's go die with him. We don't have anything better to do than to go down to that dangerous place. At least he was loyal. But as I've said, this is a dry run for the disciples. What Thomas spoke unknowingly was a prophecy. Virtually all of the apostles would end up dying for Christ. They would be scourged. They would face execution. They would face imprisonment. They would face shipwreck. They would indeed suffer in many ways, including death. If Thomas spoke a greater truth than he knew as he spoke those words. That brings us now to Jesus, the resurrection and the life in Bethany. Once again, moving from Bethany to Bethany, from Bethania to Bethany near Jerusalem. As we go to verse 17, we're looking at a four-day trip. It could start further north than Yardanit, just south of the Sea of Galilee. It would be somewhere on the east side of the Jordan River, in the region of Botanea, so northern Jordan River, upper Jordan. And the destination is just east of Jerusalem in Bethany. We do not have a description here of the trip down, but as we are in verse 17, upon arriving, Jesus found he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now it mentions, now Bethany was near Jerusalem, almost 2 miles away. So it's very close. So if Jerusalem is a dangerous place, Bethany certainly is as well. That's going to be important. That's going to factor into the story in some ways that we may not anticipate. But I've set forth a timeline for John chapter 4, verse 7 through 17. In verse 4, Jesus heard Lazarus is sick. Actually, verse 3. The courier who brought the message is now in Botanea, said he could deliver the message. We have titled this Day One. Where is Jesus? Well, he's also in Botanea. He received the message. 2 days later, because we're told that Jesus, when he heard this, he remained 2 more days where he was. So he remained in Botanea, but the courier would have left quickly to return and to tell the sisters, I have relayed the message to Jesus. He should be following shortly. So, the 2 days later, the courier is on his way going south. He hasn't yet arrived. Jesus is still in Botanea, but he clarified to the disciples, Lazarus has died. So 2 days after receiving the message, Lazarus has died. Well, then the courier would 2 days later, on the fifth day, reach Bethany. Jesus, meanwhile, is on his way. He's heading south. Then on the seventh day, Jesus reached Bethany. And presumably the courier is still in Bethany. I put it in parentheses because we're not told whether or not he was still there. Notice this sets forth a timeline down at the bottom. The courier had a 4-day journey to Bethany from Botanea, days 1 through 5. 5 minus 1 equals 4. Jesus had a 4-day journey to Bethany, days 3 through 7. 7 minus 3 equals 4. Those same days are the days that Lazarus was dead prior to Jesus' arrival. And note, as we look at verse 17, so upon arriving, Jesus found he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Jewish custom was to bury on the same day as the date of death. So Lazarus has been dead 4 days. Jesus has made a 4-day journey. Now it's very important to know that Jesus is coming from up north. That's going to have an impact upon the passage. Now what we have here is we are told that Bethany was near Jerusalem. Remember, it's only about 2 miles away. Bethany is on the eastern side of this map, and Jerusalem is there towards the left. Basically, in the center, we're looking at the temple. In verse 19, we have, let's think a little bit further about Botanea versus Bethany. The Bethany beyond the Jordan, that is Botanea, was a place of tranquility. Here we're seeing the Titanic as it is sailing in calm seas, but then all of a sudden it hit the iceberg, you've got the place of danger. There's a major difference between Botanea. He was welcomed by multitudes, and many people believe. People were saying up there in Botanea that, well, John did no signs, but everything he said about this man is true, and many believed in him. Jesus is exchanging that for the place of danger. He didn't do so on the timetable that the sisters would have wanted. Neither did he obey what his disciples wanted. His disciples wanted not to go. They would have figured, you healed the royal official's son back in John chapter 4 from a distance. Why not do that now? Why take us and make us face all this danger as well as you facing this danger down in Jerusalem? Jesus exchanged tranquility for the place of danger. Thomas has said, let's go and die with him. They're going to face those dangers themselves. As I said, Thomas spoke a greater truth than he knew. Well, here we have a Jewish funeral. This is on the eastern side of the city of Jerusalem. It's on the western slopes of the Mount of Olives. This is the area that one of my pictures showed a lot of tombs. Behind the camera is the summit of the Mount of Olives near Bethphage, and on the other side of the summit is Bethany. Well, the funeral that we're talking about in this passage was on the other side of the summit, but there were a lot of people that came. I suspect that one of the reasons that a lot of people came is that this is a wealthy family. How do we know that this is a wealthy family? Well, that episode in John chapter 12 of Mary anointing Jesus' feet with nard, we are given a value of it, and this was a wealthy family. So we have a lot of people that have come, probably a lot of them being women, but a lot of Judeans, men and women. The term that's used, the form that's used, doesn't allow us to figure out the gender of the people, but interestingly, it's the many Judeans came to the women around Mary and Martha. I didn't make a slide on that, but the women around them probably would be other family members, perhaps other sisters, cousins, and so on and so forth, very close friends, but the Judeans would be ones that probably are viewed as people coming in from Jerusalem. Now, remember I've said that Bethany is the place of danger. Some of us may remember this ad that appeared during the Super Bowl of 1984, put out by Apple Computer, and they were making IBM and the DOS world seem like Big Brother. And then this athlete came with the hammer in her arms, and she hurled it and smashed the screen, and from then on the world lived happily ever after under Apple. And what we're picturing here, though, is Jesus has entered into a place that has spies. There are people that will report what is going on. It would be known that Jesus was good friends with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. There were spies. We'll find that out later on in John chapter 11, that there were people that went and reported to the Sanhedrin that Jesus just raised Lazarus. And then there were death plots against not only Jesus, but against Lazarus, whom he had raised. There were spies. And this whole passage, as we look at it, is going to be conducted in such a way that everyone is aware that they're being watched, and it's important for them to be careful. Yes, Jesus is coming into a place of danger, but he's not coming openly. He's coming somewhat incognito, just as he had done in the trip that he made down to Jerusalem in John chapter 7, which said that he came, as it were, in secret. That's what he's doing here now. he will wait until the appropriate time to be public. So now the question becomes, how did Martha know that Jesus was near? We're told that, verse 20, so when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, is it that Jesus picked up his cell phone and said, I'm about a mile away, I'm on my way, I'm fixing to come into town? No, they didn't have cell phones. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she met him, but Mary was sitting at home. Now for this next slide, it's unfortunate. I knew that Steve Walkup was going to be in Egypt, but this next slide was for Steve. You may remember when Peyton Manning was in his early days as quarterback for Denver, that he was famously picked up on the microphone as shouting out Omaha, and that was saying, letting everyone know there with a no huddle type of play when it was that he was going to need to have the ball given to him. And so it was designed to catch the other team off guard. I think that there was a secret sign that was given. Probably Jesus sent in one of his disciples. That disciple walked in and Martha said, oh, Jesus is here. She made an exit. From the description that's given of Martha as opposed to the description of Mary both here and in Luke chapter 11, people didn't get very concerned about Martha getting up. Martha seems to be kind of on the nervous side, one who comes and goes and so forth. People didn't come up, didn't get up and follow her. On the other hand, Mary, who remained here, remained where she was. When she got up, everyone figured she's going to the tomb to weep, so they followed her. Martha was able to get out with no problem. It may well be that they had decided that Mary would remain sitting in order that the crowd wouldn't follow, in order that there could be a private meeting with Jesus. That's reading between the lines, but it's a distinct possibility. Everything here is going to be done to protect against word getting out. Somehow, Martha knew that Jesus was nearby and where to meet him prior to him coming into town. Because we're told later on that Mary came out to the place where Jesus had met Martha because he had not yet come into town. He was outside of town. Martha knew where he was. Martha went to him. Now, how we depict Martha is going to have a major impact on how we understand this passage. So as we go forward, I'm going to depict a couple of alternatives. And the first ones that I'm going to show in each case are going to be the more common views of Martha. And I think they're wrong. I think that Martha is a great hero of the faith and should be understood differently than most people have understood her. So let's depict this. Was Martha a complainer here? I'll read it as though she were. Verse 21. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Is she complaining? Is she saying, you should have been here? Why did you take your sweet time? Why didn't you come down here? You could have come down here and you could have prevented him from dying, but you didn't do that. That's not at all how I see Martha. And yet, that's often the way she's depicted. One of the reasons that people depict her that way is they do not realize that Jesus had a four-day trip all the way down from Bethania. Many people assume that Jesus came from just across the Jordan River, a one-day journey. And they think that Martha is saying, that messenger reached you a long time ago. You stayed 2 extra days, and you took your sweet time about getting here. You could have been here before he died, and you could have prevented his death. And I'm mad at you. And that's the way that most people understand Martha. This is how I see Martha. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. I believe that Martha figured out what the disciples did not figure out. You remember when they were bantering with Jesus and they were saying, you know, it's dangerous to go there to Jerusalem. The Judeans wanted to kill you, and you know, you're crazy to want to go back there. And if Lazarus is sleeping through the night, he'll get well. We don't need to go down there. We don't need to go to where it's dangerous. After all, couldn't you heal him from a distance? Why are you bringing us down to this dangerous place? And Jesus said, I rejoice that I was not there so that you may believe. Believe what? That I have the power to resurrect. Martha has figured that out already. There's strong evidence. I'm not going to give it away this week for why I would argue that within the passage there is evidence that Martha had come to understand exactly what she's saying. She's not speaking more than she knows. She's speaking what she knows. And what she knows is that Jesus has hinted, this sickness will not end in death. When did she hear that message? That messenger got down there 2 days after Lazarus had died. First thought, wait a moment, sounds like Jesus is mistaken. But I'm sure that the sisters sat there and they thought, you know, Jesus raised that boy at 9. It's mentioned in the synoptics. Jesus has power to prevent death. He has power to resurrect. He has power to raise. Jesus was saying he's going to do something because he said that this was going to glorify God. And Lazarus' death doesn't glorify God. But raising him would. The Son of God will be glorified. She's saying here, Lord, God will do what you want. You and I both know what you were hinting at. Please pray for the Father to authorize you to raise Lazarus. She is giving a testimony of her faith. She's not complaining. Jesus said, your brother will rise again. Unfortunately, many interpreters go back to the complainer and they think that she's saying, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. That's not what Martha was doing. Martha says, I know. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. But I also know, Lord, you hinted that you're going to do something now. Martha is expressing her faith over and over and over again. Now, I know some of you have looked forward at verse 39-40 and you're saying, I don't see it there. I won't give that one away. We'll talk about that next week, next time. How did Jesus respond? I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrector. He's saying, you know, I do not even need to pray to the Father on this one. The Father and I have already settled what I need to do. I'm the one who resurrects. I'm the one who grants eternal life. And so first he explains that he is the resurrector. He's the one who guarantees resurrection for all believers. He says, he who believes in me, even if he dies, shall live. Now the kind of death that he's talking about is the kind of death that Lazarus had. So the kind of life that he's talking about here is the kind of life that he's about to give to Lazarus, that is, physical life. He who believes in me, even if he dies physically, shall live physically. This is an explanation of I am the resurrection. What do you call it when someone who has died lives again physically? Resurrection. Jesus is here explaining, I am the resurrection. But then what he's going to do is he's going to clarify what he means when he said, I am the life. Now here we have the infinity symbol because he's talking about eternal life. Everyone living and believing in me shall never die. Literally, shall not die unto eternity. Shall not have an eternal death. Now the kind of living that he's, the kind of dying that he's talking about here is eternal death, but I think it is significant that living precedes believing. It's talking about the person who believes during this physical life. Everyone's going to believe that Jesus guarantees everlasting life to believers in the eternal state, but the time when a person receives eternal life is during this life. So he's saying people who believe in during this life shall not face eternal death. The positive statement of that is, I guarantee them everlasting life. So Jesus asked, do you believe this? And that's exactly what your text reads. But it is interesting, the word this is a neuter form of the word this rather than another gender. And so what Greek does is it regards phrases, sentences, paragraphs, and sections of books as neuter. So another way of looking at this is, do you believe this, that is, all of this that I just said, I am the resurrection and the life, that is, the one who believes in me and dies physically, I will raise physically, I will give that person physical life. And the one who believes in me while living shall never, ever, ever die for all eternity. That is, he has eternal life. And her answer is very simple. And once again, she has a third opportunity to express her faith. And that's what she does. Yes, Lord. I believe that. I believe all of this. I believe that you are the resurrector of those who believe in you. And I believe that you are the grantor of everlasting life to those that believe in you. And then she explains, I have believed. Now, I know our translations say I believe, but it is a perfect tense, and as a perfect tense, it's not just talking about right now I believe. She's giving a testimony of what she had already believed. I have believed this. I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. You know, if Jesus didn't grant resurrection and everlasting life to people, there wouldn't be anyone in his eternal kingdom. How would Abraham ever get there? Abraham died 2,000 plus years before Jesus was born. And yet, the Lord promised him, to you and to your seed, I give this land forever. You know, the book of Hebrews, twice in Hebrews chapter 11, in the Hall of Faith passage, says all these, including Abraham, died without having received what was promised. The only way that God can end up not being a liar is for him to resurrect believers and to grant believers everlasting life so that he can fulfill the promises that he has made to them, which are eternal in nature. For Abraham to own the land forever, because it was his and that of his seed forever, requires that he live forever, and he was going to possess it forever. Everlasting life is incumbent in what God had promised to. Martha understands that. Paul makes exactly the same point in Acts chapter 26, where he says, I am on trial for the hope of Israel. What's the hope of Israel? That God will resurrect them, give them everlasting life, and that they will dwell in the full borders of the land that were promised in Genesis chapter 15 forever. And so Paul asks the rhetorical question at the end of that. Why do you regard resurrection as incredible? Resurrection underlies the hope of Israel, their expectation of being in the land forever requires that God resurrect and grant everlasting life. And Paul said, you can't seriously believe in the hope of Israel without believing in the resurrection. Martha has had opportunity to express her faith, and she has done so repeatedly. And her words, you are the Christ. I have already believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming into the world, is echoed by John's purpose statement, John 20, 31. These eight signs have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. It is possible for unbelievers to join Martha in believing in the Messiah, the life-giving Son of God. That's what this book is about. Jesus was ministering in Bethania, Bethany beyond the Jordan. The sisters wanted him to drop everything and heal their brother. Jesus lovingly, in the plan of God and in the timetable of God, remained where he was for two more days, ministering to those people that needed to hear the message of life. Then he spoke with his disciples. As it was communicated to him that Lazarus was sick in Bethany, he relayed that message through to the messenger that this sickness is not unto death, but is for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. That messenger carried that message to sisters. He arrived after Lazarus had died, but the sisters came to understand the implication. Jesus was planning to raise Lazarus. Well, Jesus made the announcement to his disciples that he was going to go down in order to wake Lazarus. They were fearful. They pointed out, well, it's a dangerous place to go. And, you know, if Lazarus is sleeping through the night, we don't need to go there. Jesus then revealed, Lazarus has died. I need to go to wake him. Jesus also told them, there are 12 hours in a day. I'm safe. You're safe. We're going. Meanwhile, Thomas said, well, I guess we ought to go down there and join him. He spoke greater things than he knew. Because like Jesus running into the fire, like the firemen, that was going to be what the disciples were going to do during their lives. This is a passage that is a trial run for what Jesus was going to do as he would go to Jerusalem, be put to death, paying for the sin of the world, and being resurrected. So, when Jesus arrives, he has the opportunity to interview Martha. Not Martha the complainer, but Martha who repeatedly expressed her faith. She said, Lord, I know that whatever you ask God for, God will give you. I know that Lazarus will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. I also know that you were hinting that you were going to raise him before that. And she also testified, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. This is a rich passage, central to the argument of John. Questions?
John, doesn't this continue to scream out the purpose of the book of John?
Oh, absolutely.
And also, it follows the pattern because of the everyone present out at the funeral. It's a witness to other people would come to believe afterwards.
Yes. Absolutely.
John.
Yes.
Brother, would you, within John, the initial conflict with the Judean authorities begins in chapter 5?
Yes. What we see in John chapter 2, there may have been a level of conflict there possibly, but there does seem to be a recognition that Jesus is functioning at a level there that, as in John chapter 7, no one was in a position to arrest him.
If that's the case, brother, if we look at verses 21 and 26 in John chapter 5, whereas the Father raises the yes. dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. In verse 26, whereas the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself. Would this be the fulfillment of the very thing that he initially laid out for them in chapter 5, what goes on in chapter 11?
Yeah, it is a fulfillment.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like going back for the past in the long bomb.
Absolutely. Right? Yes.
This is what's going to happen. He's throwing it all the way down the field.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And your take on Martha is just outstanding. Absolutely. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, there are a lot of characters that I think have been totally misunderstood in this book. Nicodemus being one.
Amen.
And yeah, it's a fun thing to see the text and let the text open it up instead of what everyone has made pronouncement through the years. The text itself speaks eloquently in ways that are different than what the scholars tend to find themselves in agreement on.
I had not seen that perfect tense that you made mention of, and I am really thankful for that. That's outstanding.
Yeah, perfect tenses in John can be very significant. I tend sometimes to forget to translate a perfect tense in John 20:30 that way, because it's so ingrained to translate it as a present. It's usually rendered many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in his book, then in 31, but these are written. I would say, I think the perfect tense is significant there. These have been written. Why would I say that? It probably took John a period of time to write the book. You know, he's covering a lot of things, and obviously he's working under inspiration, but this wasn't something he just sat down and he just sat down in one sitting and there it is. And so as he's reflecting on the signs that he has written, it's probably been a period of time since he recorded John 2, John 4, John 5, John 6. And he's saying, these signs have been written. Yeah, I think he's looking back over it and thinking about his process of writing it. Of something that's probably taken place over a bit of time.
Brother, do you think the 40 days that the Lord spent with the disciples, or the soon-to-be apostles, do you think that was one of the things that maybe Jesus went over and to clarify for John his role there?
I would suspect that. I see hints in the last discourse that would show why John would be the author of John.
Okay.
Because Jesus said that the one who heeds his word, the Father and Son would disclose themselves to him. And in John chapter 20, verse 8, John seems to be particularly aware and able to get past the presuppositions that the disciples had before and to shed those and to allow Jesus' words to speak to him.
Now, John, in the purpose statement, you stated that in the presence of his disciples, then you go on in verse 31 and you remind us of that again. In the way you've explained that, is that because of the way it's written, or of this tense that you're talking about?
Well, the tense there would be talking about John's writing, but when he talks about in the presence of his disciples, we have the collection of disciples occurring in John chapter 1. We don't have the first sign that's recorded until John chapter 2, after he has accumulated disciples.
Yeah.
And then John chapter 4 makes a recollection that it is the second sign which he has done. Various places, we see, for example, in John chapter 21, 24, we see mention being made that we know that John's testimony is true. How do they know? Because they were there, and these things were done in their presence. Jesus speaks in terms of how they were qualified to be apostles by saying that you were from with me from the beginning. And so we have all sorts of indications that are pointing to the disciples are in a particular vantage point to speak as witnesses, because multiple disciples have seen all of the events that are recorded in John's gospel.
So then by that statement, by all these implications, you can read into verse 31, but these signs are written in the presence of his disciples because of what you just said.
Right. Yeah, he said many other signs were done in the presence of them, but these, implicitly, that were done in the presence of them, are the ones that I'm including.
Yeah. And that's a powerful statement there.
Absolutely. Yeah, you look at John 21, 24. We know that his testimony is true.
Yeah. Good work, John.
Thank you.
Hey, John. Yes. I had a couple just quick questions. Verse 4, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified through it. It seems like throughout the book of John, Jesus is always giving glory to the Father. Is this unusual that he says that the Son of God will be glorified? Or is that just my perception?
Okay, let's go to John chapter 12. Verse 27. Now my soul is troubled. And what shall I say? So he raises a hypothetical. But he's going to instantly say, no, that's not what I should say. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose, I came to this hour. So he's saying, I'm not going to pray to escape the hour. And if anyone's wondering about the Gethsemane prayers, I can explain them. My explanation is different than what you probably have heard. I think we can demonstrate it from context. But notice then he says, Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. What happens, as I would see it within the Gospel of John, Jesus makes it clear that he glorifies the Father. The Father glorifies the Son by obeying, by the Son being granted success, but Jesus glorifies the Father by doing what the Father's plan is. And what ends up happening is ultimately each member of the Trinity is bringing glory to the entire Trinity. Jesus has given emphasis upon he is giving glory to the Father, but it actually goes both ways. He's going to speak in the last discourse repeatedly about how the Holy Spirit is going to end up fitting into this same picture. And so, for Jesus to have success is success in carrying out the Father's plan. And so the Father can speak here in chapter 12 about he glorifies the Son, as well as the Son glorifying him.
Great. Then I had a question on your slide with the national religion of the different countries of the world. Was Israel a highlighted nation in your slide?
No.
Is Judaism not a national religion?
No, they have, it is it is distinct because in essence it's a secular state. The government is very secular. There are a lot of agnostics and a lot of atheists there as part of the government. In the political system that they have with a parliament, every time it comes time for a new major election, what is at issue is which party takes the majority. It never turns out that one party takes the majority because they don't have a two-party system. And it does work out that some of the Orthodox parties that only have small numbers of voters end up taking just enough seats around Jerusalem that they end up making agreements with either Likud or with one of the major parties in order to form a coalition government. And so what they do is they say, well, you need to enforce Sabbath rules. You need to do some of these things because if you don't do that, we will pull out of the coalition and you'll lose the
majority.
Yeah, you'll lose the majority, and therefore, you'll have to have a new election and so on and so forth.
Right.
But it is a secular government.